The journey to a smoke-free future can be a long and winding road, but if you're ready for a change, consider taking Zyn for a spin. Zyn nicotine pouches offer a fresh way to discover your nicotine satisfaction. Anywhere, anytime. No smoke, no spit, and no lingering odor. Get in gear with the Zyn 10 Challenge and enjoy 10 smoke-free, spit-free days for just $5.95. Order online and start your new journey today. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in LA, and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Elevation with Stephen Furtick podcast was created with you in mind. This is a podcast for those feeling discouraged or needing guidance from God. Together in this podcast, we'll dive deep into scripture, uncover the powerful truths that will help you rise above your limitations and embrace your full potential. We're here to equip you with the tools you need to conquer life's challenges. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Did you view yourself as the outsider on the show?
In life? On the show?
On the show.
Did I view Dan as the outsider?
As the outsider.
I mean, that's who he's identified as. But to me, the joke is always like, bro, how much more on the inside could you be? You're just not in the deepest of the inner circle, but you're in the same school. You're a white boy, you know. You know your dad was a rock star, and you live in a $3 million apartment rather than a $30 million mansion. So, like, if you think you're on the outside, Dan Humphrey, I'm sorry, but you have a lot of learning to do. Hi, my name is Penn Badgley, and I am you.
Hi, everybody. As always, I'm your host, Brian Baumgartner, and today we are truly going off the beat. Thanks for joining me. Today's guest, he's charming, he's thoughtful, he's incredibly likable, and he plays a serial killer on TV. I'm talking, of course, about the uber-talented Penn Badgley, a man who is as much at home on his podcast talking about the awkward middle school years as he is luring people to their deaths on the hit show, You. Talk about range. Penn and I, we have a lot in common. We're both actors. We both love many of the same people, some of whom co-starred with him on Gossip Girl, of course, where he played Dan Humphrey. And we're both always watching. No, not really. But seriously, I loved hearing about Penn's unique journey growing up on television. And now he's reflecting on it over 20 years later with his podcast, Pod Crushed, which coincidentally, I'm a guest on this month as well. Give that a listen if you want to hear about my awkward junior high years. Can't wait for you to hear this one. I won't make you wait any longer. Here he is. My new friend, Penn Badgley.
Bubble and squeak, I love it. Bubble and squeak, I know. Bubble and squeak, I cook it every moment left over from the night before.
Penn, it's great to see you. Where are you?
Yeah, you're, man. You too. I'm in New York City.
You're in New York. You're in a very official podcast studio. It's branded and everything.
It is. Well, so this is, it's funny because the first year of producing and recording our podcast, I was in a different super janky environment for every interview. And actually, if you look at some of the stuff we've put together on social media when we weren't even trying to be visual, but we just had some Zoom footage.
Right.
I'm in a different place every time. The lighting is terrible. Like, I have facial hair that's very unkempt, whereas now it's there, but it's kempt.
It's kempt.
Yeah. And so now I'm like getting used to, I get on the train and I come and it's like taken care of and we have our engineer here and we have our producer. It's like, it's, yeah, it's, if this is podcasting, sign me up.
This is it. Now I have to ask you, this is like such a lame Hollywood question. Do we know each other? Did we know each other from back in the day?
Funny, but I don't think so.
I don't think so.
But here's why it's easy to be somewhat certain. I've lived in New York for the last 15 years, and I really don't run into people the same way.
Well, see, here's the thing. I randomly became, which of course we'll talk about Gossip Girl in a little bit. I randomly became friends/friendly with virtually your entire cast in New York City.
Really?
So like Ed and Sebastian Stan and Chase and all sort of through Jess Zor.
Ah,
yes. Okay.
Yeah. So it's then, you know what?
It's possible. Maybe,
were you... It would have been in New York because yes. I really haven't been to LA much. So if you were around when the show was still on the air, when Gossip Girl was still going, then I suppose it's possible.
Yes.
But if neither of us remember it.
It probably wasn't.
I think we can go ahead and say nice to meet you.
Yeah, nice to meet you. That sounds, that makes sense. Nice to meet you. Yes. You know, Gossip Girl started shortly before The Office and you guys were so big and so hip, which was the opposite of us at that time. When we started, but also, but even throughout, you know, we weren't like paparazzi stalked, like we weren't living that sort of Gossip Girl type life, I guess.
Right. You're just creating the most watched television show, I think, in history. Is that now what The Office is, the U.S. Office?
It's for sure now. I don't know. Maybe I Love Lucy or something is still.
Okay. Yeah.
Is still bigger. But So I had some crazy like New York experiences like, this is the back door of a place. I wasn't used to all of that. Yes.
I still don't know how to get in the front door. I have actually talked my way into the front door of a club exactly once in my life in the first season of Gossip Girl.
Yes.
The first and last time I ever did it. I still don't know how to wield that hammer. And it's comical. But, you know, if a back door is open to me and I'm being ushered through it, sure thing.
Yeah, it's easy. Yeah. All right. Well, I want to start back before that. You're a difficult guy to pin down in terms of the question, where are you from? It sounds like you were born in Maryland and then moved to Virginia.
Yeah. Yep. At 2 years old, packed up my bags. Yeah. Then I was also in Washington State by the time I was, I think, 8 or 9. And then I was in LA, pursuing a career as an actor at the ripe old age of 12.
Right.
And by the time I was 20, I was in New York City.
Okay. So you went the opposite way. You're one of the very, very few who moved from LA to New York. You know, that doesn't usually happen.
No, I mean, I was really lucky in a number of ways when Gossip Girl came along, even though it was something that I have spoken a lot about how, like, you know, sort of in the beginning, I wasn't sure. That seems to be the way I sign on to things because it was the same with my show, You Now. But one of the great gifts it brought was living in New York City. Truly, any other life is a fantasy, but I can't imagine not having been in New York in my 20s.
Right.
And it's very intense, by the way. Like, the city is exhausting, so that 15, 16 years later, I'm like, you know, having to process what that was. But it's an incredible place to be.
Where would you say, what place influenced you the most before your move to New York? It sounds like you were in Washington State for quite a while.
Yeah, everywhere was a different kind of influence, each one of them pretty deep. I think the one that resonates the most is Washington State because of that age. Mm-hmm. I was like 9 to 12, and those are such formative years. And then by the time I was in LA, those are formative years as well. But then, of course, like any teenager, I became to disdain the place that I lived. And I think being an actor, you, of course, you know, the relationship you develop with LA is different than if you do something else.
Right.
You know, and so I think by the time I was 20, I really wanted to get out. I'd always wanted to live in New York. And so then the opportunity came. And so, yeah, I'd say Washington State. That place is the place that feels like my home before it all kind of started.
Before it started. Were you named after a tennis ball brand?
I was indeed. Now, that doesn't really mean anything because there was no attachment to the brand. My parents were not, that's not even, that's, it's
they
funny.
They were tennis players?
Well, my dad was a tennis player, but not, you know, I mean, it's like, it was more of a happenstance where he was bouncing and gripping a Penn tennis ball, just sort of like, because it was there and it was a stress thing. And my mom said, oh, he's about the size of that tennis ball right now. I think they'd just gotten the first sonogram.
Okay.
I don't know if the story is, I don't know if they were actually in the hospital at the time or if what it was, and then he just looked at the ball and then in that moment they knew.
Penn.
That's the, yeah.
Fascinating. Do you think that bounciness influenced anything later on? Back and forth?
That's interesting. I've never thought of that. And my relationship to tennis is, I really like to watch it, but I've never been a tennis person. Here's where the name means something to me is I went through this phase where I got into the etymology of the word pen, like a writing pen, even though that's okay. Technically not, I mean, it has an extra N, so I don't know if that just makes it a name or whatever, but like the idea that a pen point is like the point where things come to a head. It kind of used to mean like a general, I think. In Germanic, it's sort of like the root of the word used for a general.
Okay.
Yeah, it's kind of, I don't know, interesting esoteric stuff. But no, the name doesn't, I like it because it's unique.
Yes.
I rarely ever see the name or hear the name in any other reference than to me. You know what I mean? So
yes.
That's kind of interesting. Like, you know, yes. People who have a name like that's more common, they're accustomed to meeting people with their name. I have only met one other person named Penn. And incidentally, my mother's neighbor, for a very brief period, my mother lived in Colorado. And she actually, when she first moved in to this suburban street in Colorado, this is like, I don't want to say 6, 7, 8 years ago, she had somebody left cookies on her front door and it said, you know, nice to meet you, neighbor, signed Penn. And my mom, the way she describes it, she literally was like, what? And like, she didn't see who it was. She was just she was having like a brain glitch, like a Matrix moment, you know, like, what do you mean? That's not possible. And it turns out the woman who lived next door, she was like in her 40s. I think she had like 2 kids. She was from, her heritage is West Indies. So she's black. And so it's an interesting, funny story that the only other woman me or my family has ever met was an older black woman who lived next door to my mom.
Hmm.
You know, that's kind of, I like that the name has that spectrum.
Yeah, it does.
You know, like it's very cool.
It does. It transverses the world. Now, I have to tell you, in the weirdest coincidence ever, I have only met one other Penn. And
Gillette?
I spoke to him for this podcast.
Oh, wow.
Very, very recently. And I will tell you, well, you have a lot to live up to. He's fascinating.
Yeah, he's pretty amazing.
Incredibly smart and intuitive. And he immediately invited me, well, not immediately, but at the end of our conversation, invited me to a show of his in Vegas. And I have never been. And I after the conversation, I was like, anytime. And I will just fly there to come and hang out with you and
you
see
know
your
what,
show.
Man? That actually makes me feel like I've never felt this way about like another quote unquote celebrity. That's sort of, I don't operate like that, but that just made me realize like he is the only other famous Penn I'm aware of.
Yes.
And he's a profound dude. He's like, their act Penn and Teller is I think brilliant. I mean, I've never really dug into it, but I've never seen it live, but you're making me feel like, somehow I really want to reach out to him and just because he is so smart.
You need to. And yeah, Penn and Penn.
Yeah.
Penn and Penn.
That's an episode. We got to get him for our podcast.
Yeah. Penn and Penn.
Yeah.
Just give me credit, just in the bottom corner.
Definitely. You're not going to get any points or anything. But well,
no, I don't. Points get you points. Literally
does that even
nothing.
Does it,
yeah, no, it's just nothing.
I've never had points in anything yet. No. So.
Come on. Points are what you get when something is not worth anything.
Right.
Oh, no.
However, if you get in, I mean, you know, on a show like yours, or if it's, I know, I'm not saying that you guys did it. I'm just saying, like, there is that rare, like Keanu Reeves famously got, didn't he, rather than getting paid a lot for The Matrix, he got some points.
Well, like, those are good points to have.
Yeah, exactly.
Those were really
good points.
If you
can stumble onto something that is going to turn into a giant.
Yes. When did you start becoming interested in acting? Now, I understand you did some stuff for Seattle Children's Theater, so this is young, but was this a hobby or was this something you were really interested in pursuing?
I mean, both. It went from a hobby. My first creative passion was music. Mm-hmm. That was kind of from birth, pretty evidently, which with my toddler actually seems to be the same case. Hmm. Really, really has loved music from the get-go and has a very specific kind of taste. So yeah, singing, performing in that way was like something that I think my heart desired, but the way it became acting, I can't really recall, except that there were some school plays pretty young.
Okay.
But then really what did it was that I was clearly a very creative person. Actually, the thing I spent the most time doing was drawing.
Okay.
I would draw and listen to music, and I didn't sing that much at that point. But then when we moved to Washington State, we lived in the middle of nowhere and I needed a social outlet because it was just the beginning of summer. I had no school, nothing like that. And my mom and I would drive to this theater house that was like 50 miles away in a town called Monroe. And that was when I fell in love with the practice, a crew, a cast, you know, like there's sometimes nothing better. It's like this communal experience. You get to meet so many different kinds of people, especially when you're that age. You know, most kids are surrounded by kids only their age, which is a construct of school. You think about it, it's not totally natural.
Right.
What I loved being around just adults and all different kinds of people, creative people. I really loved it. And then I saw Seattle as this like, because I didn't live in Seattle. And when I would go into Seattle later when I was doing plays in the city, it just felt so metropolitan, would go to the museum and stuff. It just felt like the arts were this access to the world, you know? And so I didn't just love acting. I loved the entire thing, you know? It just was like magical. It was lovely. And so I couldn't imagine doing anything else.
You bring up something I've never thought about before, but it's so true. I mean, if you think about school, and you think about sports even at a young age too, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like you're playing with 9 and 10 year olds or 11, you know, in mm-hmm. on teams. But theater specifically is one place where you have the opportunity to be around and in a way be on the same team with a variety of ages and types and sexes and mm-hmm. everything. That's so valuable, I would
say. It is. No, I mean, I actually think it's a more natural way for people to grow up, because you think about schools haven't existed that long.
Right.
Like we're right. Normally, the world is mixed age.
Right.
Like, you know, you're going to be in the world. So in a way, I grew up like in the world. And I think, look, I mean, it has its taxes, it has its cost, but there's something about that I always loved. I really always loved. And I stopped going to school in a traditional sense pretty early on. So, you know, yeah, I've come to appreciate it.
Did you graduate high school at age 13?
Technically, what I did was took the California High School State Proficiency Exam. So that's now referred to as the CHESPE because it's a bit more popular for kids who are seeking to... Basically, what it does is it allows you to work without a tutor on set.
Oh.
And without the constraints of like the 8.5 hours or whatever that is. So like I could work for 12 hours and I wouldn't have to have a tutor. And you know, if you're an autodidact, if you like learning, that's not a bad thing at all, because the set tutor is a little bit of a, I didn't vibe with it. And,
right.
And I'm, again, like, I'm not recommending it for all people, but the way that it worked for me was that it worked.
Fascinating. So like basically the equivalent of a GED or something?
It's the exact same thing. It's just a GED, I think, is a national thing.
Okay.
This is just in the state of California. So what I did was I started going to Santa Monica College. I don't know if you've ever been there, but it's a really cool kind of like cultural hub too.
Yes.
So it was another example of how this profession sort of kept opening up the world to me. You know, I was taking sociology at a college level when I was like 14. And I loved that. I loved that. I took photography, you know, and I was taking drawing and I was drawing models, you know, and stuff. It was just loved it. Really, really loved it.
Well, again, this makes a ton of sense. I mean, if you're someone who is interested in the world and wanting to be educated, but not wanting to be because you're working, because you're pursuing something you love, not wanting to be held with those constraints that are sort of artificial, but being able to actually begin focusing and expanding your knowledge with things that you're interested in, that makes a ton of sense.
Yeah.
I've actually never heard of that. I've never, maybe I haven't been around smart kids. I never occurred to me that, oh, well, if you place out, you don't have to be under those same rules or do the set school or whatever.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and to be, again, to kind of underscore, like I didn't test out of high school in that way that you would think of. What really started happening was that like this other way of being able to make things work and have a sort of a career, an occupation, started to present itself very early, so that it seemed like a safe enough gamble to be like, you know what? What do people go to school for? What do they do it for? They do it to set them up, right? I mean, you don't, like, unfortunately, people don't really go there to learn. You do it because you basically have to. If you don't go to school, child services will be called on your parents at some point.
Right, right.
So, you know, it's like, but that's, again, this is kind of a construct. Like, and so, and you know, I don't believe in children should not all go to Hollywood. It's the last place, really, they should be.
Right.
You know, so it's like, it does not work for everybody. But I managed to cut a path that again, it came with some costs, but ultimately, like, was this really rich sort of exposure to culture and a different kind of education that, you know, I never lost the love for learning, actually.
Right.
And that's interesting because a lot of people get to college and they're just exhausted by the academic experience. I personally, you know, I read more than most people I know. And I think one of the reasons is this.
Right.
I just love to absorb, you know.
You went to Los Angeles then specifically at that point, 13, 14, to pursue a career.
Yeah. Yeah. The cliff notes are yes. The longer answer is no one at 13, no one as a child is going with a parent to LA to pursue a career without some aspect of the family being like people needing to get away from each other, parents getting divorced, that sort of thing. So it's, you know, it's always, I mean, if you look at Hollywood as a control experiment or something, you know that child actors are coming from often a lot of stuff. And so that was a part of it, but I did have the genuine desire to act, to pursue a life as a creative person, as an artist. And I'm not even saying that that's what I achieved, but that is what brought me there. And, you know, and then I started working right off the bat in television, and I virtually have not stopped since.
Yeah. You had a number of recurring roles early on. Young and the Restless, which, by the way, in terms of an education, doing a soap opera, learning quickly how to be on set and how to be efficient and work. That's a great education, right?
Yeah. I mean, I did it briefly enough that I think it kept me working. It kept me like I didn't study a lot as an actor. I was just sort of learning by doing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, it all was training. It all, you know, all those sort of recurring roles. I remember being very, very nervous every time I went to Young and the Restless because it was right next to the Price is Right studio.
Okay.
And that just is an iconic kind of, I mean, young people now probably don't even know what that is, but like, you know, it just was in the days of network television being the only way you consume anything and it being like a pillar of everybody's sort of life, you know, right. Just television is there to raise me.
Right.
And, you know, The Price is Right is there to keep me company. And you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
So The Price is Right being a living, real thing right next to where we shot and everything, as you said, it moves fast. So like as a kid, oh man, actually, I haven't thought about this in a long time, but I was always so nervous going to work there because it just seemed huge. It was the CBS studios, you know, CBS Radford, just this like giant kind of old Hollywood vibe. Everybody, yeah, it's woof.
Yeah.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am, like I am, where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how, I don't know where, I don't know what. God, if you show me, God, if you tell me, God, if, no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart's Outspoken Network for a year, and what a year it has been. Every weekday, I navigate our rapidly changing world alongside our series of fabulous expert guests. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Woke not just to the latest headlines, but also to the collective power we all have. Woke to the need to build community with those around us. Woke to how to avoid burnout and woke to the ways we can all find joy in the madness. Make Woke AF Daily with Danielle Moody your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. And tune in to hear the ways I am working to stay grounded amidst it all. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm always fascinated with people who get into the business, and I hate the phrase the business, but I just used it early. Do you feel like you had a normal childhood?
No. Okay. No, not at all. No, I mean, in fact, part of what I even started my podcast for, which is like, it's called Podcrushed. This is not a plug. It's just the truth.
Yeah.
We're exploring middle school partly. I mean, my two co-hosts have their own middle school experiences, their own life experiences. Actually, they're teachers. They were teachers before they left it all to come stars. No, that's not what they're doing. But but I'm kind of openly processing what it was to have a late childhood and and adolescence and teen years and even early and even my 20s in this business, you know, and under the public eye more and more. And it's not normal. Yeah, it's like face value. It's like, wouldn't recommend it. It's like, if you go that route, be ready for some life brings us all challenges. I would say this kind of challenge is extreme and it's unique, and there's no clear reason anybody should subject themselves to it. That's what I would say.
except that you loved it.
Well, yeah. And so that's true. I mean, look, yes. But you know, I love the whole thing, and my pure love of the craft ultimately is what's carried me through. But so much of it, I don't feel as though I've spent like refining the very, participating in the art and refining the craft in its purest sense, so that, like, you know, I don't feel as though I've been living my life as like a working artist. That's not really what it feels like. It feels like I got into this business and it's very much a business. And then I spent a really long time doing, like, succeeding in the business as a player in it. And then I think only now, after all this time, do I start to really feel as though I can take some control of that and reclaim this feeling of being an artist, to be honest.
Yeah. Again, it's always interesting to me when I talk to someone who started so young, because I didn't, quite frankly. And even talking about, you know, being involved in theater and, you know, having a variety, you know, being around people of different age, that really wasn't my experience, because, you know, I was essentially early on doing school plays. So
right, it was all your age.
Yeah, it was all my age, essentially. So, you know, I was even then playing the 60-year-old man or whatever, but, you know, the next to my friend was playing the young lover or whatever. So it was just very, and it wasn't until after I got out of school that really started for me. But I find it so interesting, and it makes sense that at such a young age you would feel sort of out of control and trying to find your way and make your way, and not being able to sort of guide yourself down, you know, as you say, an artist path, but really just trying to survive and then, you know, in your case, succeed in the business of acting.
Yeah, which, by the way, is a statistical anomaly. Success in the business is actually the exception that proves the rule that you will fail. I mean, not to sound like...
Right.
What I mean is that anyone you succeeding is actually the anomaly.
Yes.
The business is not one that offers any kind of like merit-based metric. It is you see someone doing what you want to do, guess what? If it's a numbers thing, that they're doing it means that you can't,
right.
That you won't.
Right.
Yeah, not based on your worth, not based on fairness.
No.
This is not just, but it is the way that it is. Like, the percentage of people who succeed versus the percentage of people who fail is so disproportionate. So even succeeding in all of it is like, wow, it's a crazy thing that we do.
You, 19, 20 years old, you already have a ton of credits under your belt.
I was ready. I'm not kidding. I was ready to hang it up before I took Gossip Girl. I had been doing television for so long.
Really?
And was already so disillusioned with the process. I had done so many shows, series leads, series that had all gone to series, not just pilots, that had then failed and been canceled. We try to get that back nine. You know what I mean?
Right.
You know, the first season of The Office, you know how the struggle it can be to get a show, to make it. And I was just like, you know, I can't do TV anymore. I just can't. And that's why when Gossip Girl came along, I initially did say no. But anyway, sorry.
So you the opportunity for Gossip Girl comes and you say no.
Yeah. I mean, so the co-creator, Stephanie Savage, she actually asked me, she emailed me the script, and she said, you know, I feel like you will have already, her words in my memory are, I think that you will feel like you've already done this, which is play the floppy-haired awkward kid.
Okay.
Because that's what I had done on the show we'd worked together on like 2 or 3 years previous. When I was 17 years old, I lived in Vancouver for about 6 months on a show called The Mountain, where I was playing this young professional snowboarder, and a show that was basically like, the pitch was it was Dynasty on a mountain.
Okay.
And she co-created that show with Mick G, who at the time was huge with the OC and all this stuff.
Yep.
So then she and Josh Schwartz get together to make Gossip Girl. And she emails me the concept, the script, and was like, I would really love you to look at Dan, even though I feel like you'll probably not want to do it. And I read it and I said, thank you. And you're right. You know, thank you for thinking of me. But
right.
Respectfully, like, yeah, this is just not what I'm interested in doing right now. And the opportunity went away and they cast everybody else. Couldn't find who they thought was Dan. She comes back and sort of gives me a little bit of a plea. Plea maybe sounds not, it wasn't like desperate. It was more like she pitched me on the idea that I was Dan. And I ultimately was sold on it and said yes.
Why? What made you change your mind?
Honestly, something that did not even pan out. Like, I don't feel like she meant what she said, but what she said was that she was interested in the fact that he was like the sort of moral center of the show, like the sort of male lead of the show, I think at its outset. And she was sort of pitching me on like this idea that 3 years prior I'd done a show where I started out in a recurring role. And then that role became slowly kind of the heart of how she saw the show. That it became, I was in every episode, I think, in the end. And by the end, I was like a really main character. And she was like, you know, think about that was the arc with your last guy, you know. And I'd done another series with Warner Brothers since then. And actually, he was in college. So I was taking a step back into high school. And at 20 years old, I was like, I'm a high schooler. Are you kidding me? Like, I'm... Like my sideburns are down to my jaw. I'm not like, you know, all I want to do is go forward.
I graduated at 13.
Right. I've never even been to high school. And I honestly was just, I just so wanted to play other things and other people and other ideas. But she kind of had this idea. She was like, you know, this time you'll be starting out as this sort of heart of the show, and you know, just think of where it can go from there. And what's interesting about Gossip Girl, and I say this as a witness, not as like a, I think I took it personally initially, and I complained as a youngin. But what I see it now, just purely with detachment and like, you know, distance and time, the whole point of Gossip Girl was that Dan was not meant to. He was not the heart. Like the show wasn't so concerned with having a heart. It was concerned with this aspirational, as we say, this sort of fantasy of the elite, you know, of the glamorous, of which basically doesn't exist, you know, but yeah, it's this like fantasy life of youth. And actually in Chuck and Blair, who I think very quickly became the clear heart or hearts of the show, or the bivalve heart of the show, the whole point was that they were not moral. The whole point was that they weren't immoral, but they were amoral. They were sort of like, they did what served them. And at the end of the day, because they were portrayed by two talented actors, those characters had such depth and such range. Because actually, when you play people who are not sure about what's right, you ultimately get a more compelling story. And I mean, that's why, you know, years later, I'm playing a serial killer and people haven't ever responded more positively, you know? And I think that's a sign of like the sort of stories that we're interested in and what we get from stories. It's actually very hard to tell a story about a moral center. It's I'm not saying that it's not a good story. I'm not saying it's not worth trying, but I'm saying that it's currently we live in an age where it's more compelling off the bat to tell a story about a bad person who's trying, because I think we can identify more readily with that visceral level of struggle.
100%. And people also don't want to be told
what is
right.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, that's never worked with anybody. So yeah.
Yeah. Then it becomes preaching.
Well, exactly. And I think in some sense, Dan, coupled with the way that I unconsciously played him, became righteous and annoying, you know, and that makes sense. At least I'll say this. I think true stands of Gossip Girl usually seem to align with the Chuck and Blair kind of like thing. And that's that. I do think it really seems to me like I remember when it happened the first season. It was episode 6. They were the kind of unexpected relationship that then just worked. And then it became the heart of the show, really. And I think that no one anticipated that, but it was a sign of the times. It was like, ah, and a sign of what you just said, which is like, you can't start out with somebody who's like always right or something, or who always thinks that they're good and then just complains about how no one else is as good as them. That's not as interesting. It's actually not humble in the end.
Did you view yourself as the outsider on the show?
In life?
On the show.
Did I view Dan as the outsider? I mean, that's who he's identified as. But to me, the joke is always like, bro, how much more on the inside could you be? You're just not in the deepest of the inner circle, but you're in the same school. You're a white boy. You know, you know, your dad was a rock star and you live in a $3 million apartment rather than a $30 million mansion. So like, if you think you're on the outside, Dan Humphrey, I'm sorry, but you have a lot of learning to do. You just aren't literally inside the inside of the inside. You're just on the outskirt of the inside, you know, so.
When did you find out that
he's Gossip Girl?
Were the Gossip Girl?
I think right, like just the day before we started shooting that final episode.
Okay.
I believe. Now at the beginning of that season, the producers did tell me, they kind of cryptically, like, Dan is going to assume more power this season, so just get ready. And you know, typically seasons are 26 episodes, but we that season only did a half order, like of 10 or something like that. So I remember thinking like, well, I guess we're going to have to get there pretty soon, aren't we? Like, but I didn't know what that meant. And I didn't even think that it was about being Gossip Girl at all, like not even remotely. Because, you know, if you try to break it down logically, it's, you know, it doesn't really make sense for anybody to have been Gossip Girl other than Dorota or some other more peripheral character.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this marks the first time that you work on a really long running show with the same group of people, largely the same cast. How is that different for you? One, playing that character, being able to play through multiple arcs over several seasons, but also play alongside your castmates for that long.
You know, it's a lot of things. I mean, the first things that come to mind are totally like sensory, emotional, like, man, it was just those super formative years of being in your early and mid 20s and youth. How was it? You know, the arcs, the character, the cast. I feel like for me, I was never as invested in the story as I was in the experience. I was never as invested in the show as I was in like the set, like the cast and crew. I was never as invested in Dan as I was in having new experiences as an actor. And so unfortunately, I think what that meant as a young and hungry professional, I constantly felt the limitations of the show and the role, which is not right. You know, it is, I think, common for such young people thrust into that position. But what I do think, I mean, you know, I had, of course, the first couple of years had a relationship with Blake Lively, and that was its own bubble experience of portraying Dan and Serena and being together. And that was really, when you break it down, that's actually a very surreal experience. Another one I would not necessarily recommend to others, but if you somehow find yourself there, go ahead and journal, because it's weird. Of course, which I'll, you know, always be grateful for those experiences. Really, really lovely things ultimately win out in memory, but weird, you know, it's an intense way to do things. And yeah, I don't even know what I think about the character, because to me, it's very, that show was so intimately connected to our personal lives in the tabloids.
Yes.
I gotta honestly say, like, and I'm saying this again, as a witness, this is not in the realm of complaint. I really see it as like, we were too young to really understand what was going on. It was too much of a frothy pop gossip kind of engine on its own, you know? And I just feel like it was very hard to separate life from fiction. And
yes.
And I personally didn't like that. I actually didn't want more of that.
I don't know how you guys did it. Now, I joked with Jess Zor about this, and I was not going to say this to you because I didn't know what your experience was or what, you know. I don't follow the tabloids, so I don't. To me, it doesn't matter what the machinations or what the pairings were, but all I know is every time I would run into those guys, which I would run into Jess or Chase or Sebastian or Ed, as I mentioned, at various times throughout the year, but months would go by because I was in LA and you guys were in New York. I couldn't keep it straight. Yeah. I couldn't keep it straight. Who was with who? Because I felt like one summer, two of you guys would be together. And by Christmas time, that wasn't happening anymore.
Oh, yeah,
but everybody was still cool with each other and going out together.
Yeah. I mean,
but now you were with someone else and it was playing out differently on the show. So that was confusing. I don't know how you did it. I don't know how you lived through it. I truly don't.
Again, I don't recommend it to anybody, but if you find yourself in the position, journal, my friend, you journal like you have never journaled before. It'll be really interesting later on, and you're going to need to process it with your therapist. So just a shortcut. You cling to that journal, young gossip girl. You cling on to it like your sanity depends on it. You know, what's funny is that I didn't journal throughout those years, which is why I'm saying this. But man, look, I mean, it is a completely constructed thing. It's not normal we're portraying people younger than we are.
Yes.
Who live relationships as though they're 40-year-old billionaires.
Right.
You know, the level of emotional nuance and like sexual experience that all these teenagers are meant to be demonstrating, it literally is more like the love lives of a theater company in Paris in like 1920. Like, it's not the way that teenagers live, and not even most adults in America live.
Right.
But then, you know, so we're there kind of bringing that thing to life. And then, but then you keep us together for years on end without any course elsewhere. Like, we couldn't, unless we die on the show, we can't get out of this thing. We're not going to. So we're continually thrust together. And I think the reality is that young actors, actors in general, really relate to one another in a way that no one else is going to be able to relate, which is often why they find relationships together. You know, it's actually why I cherish so much that my wife is not an actress.
Yes.
But I realize now why I had a couple of significant relationships with actresses, because no one else can quite understand what you're doing. And uniquely on that show, what was happening then. So, you know,
that's right. That's right. No, but you guys at that time, and part of it was in New York too. I mean, I think that's a huge,
New York City.
Huge part. You were the biggest kind of pop hit culture show in New York, and who else can relate to you at that? Well, just one of the people you're working with.
Exactly. No, exactly. And I, you know, to be fair, the way that Blake and I got in relationship and sort of more or less clung to one another, I think it was a safety, and it worked, by the way. Like, I think those first couple of years of the show was when we were all going to get broadsided by fame and all that more than any other, you know? And I think in a way it was a safety mechanism. Like, I'm not saying that it wasn't a legitimate relationship and we loved each other and stuff, but it, you know, when I look back, I'm like, man, I'm thankful for that relationship for that reason, you know? We actually didn't engage socially the same way that everyone else kind of was thrust into it, because, you know, the other relationships were cycling through a lot faster, and for better or worse, ours was longer, and I do think it was a safety.
You keep in touch with those guys still?
You know, so I had Chase on the show, and I had Leighton on the show, and Sebastian. So it's kind of like a smattering. We're like roommates from college where we remember each other fondly, but we're not always in touch, you know?
Yeah. You talked earlier of your first and maybe more significant love of music. I want to talk to you a little bit about Mother.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
With an X.
With an X.
Yes. I have to be clear about that. Were you excited? I mean, this starts around the time Gossip Girl ends. Were you excited to do something in a new direction and pursue that sort of original love?
Very. Yeah. Actually, you know, it's funny. I haven't spoken about Mother really in an interview at length in a while, I don't think. So thank you for the opportunity. So by the time Gossip Girl was ending, so remember how I said that I was kind of thinking about hanging it up, at mm-hmm. least in terms of television, by the time Gossip Girl came around.
Right.
So I felt that way even more so by the end of Gossip Girl.
Okay.
Because it was such a full-on experience. I really wanted to pursue acting more. I didn't know what kind of opportunities would present themselves. So I knew, you know, I'd done a few great film roles that were very encouraging and inspiring, and that ultimately led to music, because I played a role. I played Jeff Buckley in this very kind of small, quiet biopic. It was not a traditional biopic in that sense. It's just like this little snapshot, very kind of vibey movie. And playing a musician, you know, it was just finally kind of things felt like they were meeting where I loved, and then after, so Gossip Girl ends and I just really wanted to play music. And the key thing is that I had this great friendship with, his name is Jimmy Giannopoulos, who's actually now directing movies. And I've done, is it one or two? I feel like I've done bit parts in at least one of his movies, but it's funny that I can't remember, because that's the nature of our relationship. We met back in 2011. We just immediately knew that we would make things together. By the time Gossip Girl ends in late 2012, finally there's some time. We start recording this thing. We include two other friends. The four of us become this really tight-knit unit for like a month and make this record. And then we got a deal and toured that record on and off for 3 years. And by the end of those 3 years, we had done what is very hard to do. We'd gotten to a point where we could sell out, you know, like a 500 capacity club in all the major, in like a major city, like New York, mm-hmm. London, LA, places in South America as well. Like, and we could have actually continued, except for the fact that like we'd overcome those professional hurdles of making music that people want to go see and pay money for in the age of streaming, which is a racket. I don't know how people do it now. It's just insane. But the four of us were now on friendly terms, but we really couldn't work together creatively then. It was something about the foundation of the way it all started. It just didn't really pave the way for more than one record to be made. We couldn't, we didn't find that we could work together in the same way. And that's a shame, but it's also, I think, very common. You know, it's hard to, it's like being married to three other guys, you know, engaging in a creative and business partnership is like, whew, you better get ready. Again, cling to your journal. That is my mantra for today.
Well, but, and you're also spending, I mean, so you're engaging in business and creative, and then you're, as you say, you're going on tour. So yeah, then you're also living together.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And you know, and traveling, and like sleeping in vans together. And it's always so scrappy, because you need to make a lot of money to be able to do that in a way that is not scrappy, touring. And, so it was really, it was great. It was actually, you know what? It was a little bit like I was finally doing what I never got to do as a teenager. But it was in my mid to late 20s. I was getting to have a band.
Right.
And like grow out my hair. And we started in shows that were so small and so bad. And then by the end of it, we were actually knowing how to really like rock a crowd of 500 to 600 people. It was like, and we also did play, we got the chance to open for much bigger acts and play big festivals. And we would sometimes play for crowds that were like 10, 15,000. And that was, man, that was actually, I can't believe we did that. It's really, it's really, really a lot, that, that level of performance. But when you find yourself in those moments, like, it is special. It's very special.
Yeah. But no more albums from Mother.
Not from Mother, no. And I mean, all those guys kept going on with it, and they're all very talented producers and songwriters and musicians in their own right. And they're all just, you know, making it work the way that artists do. But yeah, and I might actually get it together and put out a record of some kind in the future. But I, you know, that's not, it's what I was saying earlier about just like the racket, the age of streaming. The same way that it's changed television in a large part and film, it's changed music even more, I think, because it's like the only way to make money is to tour. And touring is a very intense lifestyle. And yes. So I think in order to make it worth it, you need to be very successful.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am like I am where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how. I don't know where. I don't know what. God, if you show me. God, if you tell me. God, if no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart's Outspoken Network for a year, and what a year it has been. Every weekday, I navigate our rapidly changing world alongside our series of fabulous expert guests. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Woke not just to the latest headlines, but also to the collective power we all have. Woke to the need to build community with those around us. Woke to how to avoid burnout. And woke to the ways we can all find joy in the madness. Make Woke AF Daily with Danielle Moody your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. And tune in to hear the ways I am working to stay grounded amidst it all. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You had a song on the album called Victim. Attempting to make one of the greatest segues in the history of podcasting.
I think I know where you're going with this.
Your next show is you. Come on.
That was pretty good, Brian.
That was pretty good.
I have to hand it to you. That is.
We're going.
It's certainly the most unique segue I've gotten. And I do want to say it's the best. I'm going to give it to you. Because that's a good song, too. It's one of my favorite songs of ours.
I knew that. That's why I said it. Stalker, murderer, Joe Goldberg, and you. Now, I have to tell you, I guess the word is binged. I binged season one. I have watched every episode of the show. We were talking about before, so I'm going to bring it up now because we're talking about you. It is in line with what, you know, many people call the golden age of television, which I identify as being the time where we found the anti-hero.
Yeah, I would agree with you there. Yeah.
The greatest, you know, in my opinion, being Tony Soprano.
Bad. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Or Walter White, Breaking Bad. Many, many others. And it's compelling in that way. But of course, different.
It is different because it's funny when you say, when you bring up those two, I mean, I don't ever in my mind include Joe Goldberg in the same realm, and I'm not giving the same kind of performance, and it isn't the same kind of show, but you are right that it is part of, in a way, I feel like my show, you, is now kind of like an entrance into the next iteration of this golden era where of the anti-hero, because the show is so like almost like self-referencing. It is poppier. It's not
yes.
a clinical portrayal of a real killer. It's, you know what I mean? It's not
yes.
a man falling from grace. It's a man starting out as this sort of like evil deconstruction of the same tropes we've been imbibing for the last couple decades, you know, in like John Hughes movies and stuff.
Yes.
Romantic tropes of a good man.
Yes, I think that's true. Yeah, and there's never a real attempt to be good, yet
no,
we
yeah.
do find ourselves caring about him and what ultimately is going to happen to him. I understand you almost didn't take this role as well, right?
Evidently, that's just part of my character, my Penn Badgley's character flaws.
Yes.
Yes, I was in a similar position where... So after my band Mother, actually, you know what? This was a good segue because you're kind of mm-hmm. going through the actual timeline here. I haven't done an interview like this in a very long time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So kudos to you. Mm-hmm. So my band had just dissolved. We had just done the thing that was very hard to do and then realized we couldn't make another record. And so that was a bit dispiriting. I was considering exploring a solo career in music and actually had some meetings set up with labels.
Okay.
And this script comes along. And again, I actually was like, you know what? This is not initially what I'm interested in. It just felt like I couldn't appreciate the places it would go and how different it actually was. Because, you know, when television, you only get to read the pilot.
Right.
And in the pilot, a lot of what I was resisting was where I felt like I saw Dan Humphrey. You know what I mean? And if you look at the very first scene where Joe meets Beck, I'm basically Dan Humphrey. And then
performance wise, or do you mean the character?
I actually mean in every way, the way that I look, the way that I'm acting, the way that the character's behaving, this sort of conceit of a man falling in love with a woman who's unattainable, but who he's eventually going to end up with.
Okay.
You know what I mean? It's like, it's
insane. I don't remember the first scene, but I believe I'm going to go back and look. Are you in a bookstore?
Yeah.
Okay.
And Dan was a writer, you know.
Right.
So I think what actually, the reason it all works and what's brilliant about it is that it's kind of picking up, not where Gossip Girl and Dan left off, but it's picking up where that era of that kind of show leaves off. Because look, even the Gossip Girl reboot, it doesn't hit the same, like we don't live in the same age. We don't live in the same political time. We don't live in the same time where, like, the way climate change literally generates anxiety in generations of youth. We didn't have that. We should have, by the way, but we didn't have it in 2007.
Right.
You know, like it's just not the same. People don't feel the same. People don't, you know, so therefore they don't want to see the same thing. And I think why my show You works is that it kind of brilliantly sees that, takes the sort of conceit of a romantic lead, whether he's Dan Humphrey or he's from something nearly three decades prior in a John Hughes film, you know, and it starts there, but says, there's something wrong with this. There's something wrong with these ideas. Let's start. And I'm not saying that there's nothing right about the idea of romance in the way we've seen it in movies, but this show is not a show that's doing that. It's exploring what's really actually kind of crazy and toxic about a lot of romantic tropes, particularly in the portrayal of men as romantic leads, kind of like needing to win the affection of women and thereby just sort of perpetually objectifying them. So I think to me, that's what's really cool, but I couldn't feel and see all of that when I first read the pilot. I really just saw the things that it shared as opposed to the things that it did really differently. And so I was really, really hesitant and sort of tried to say no to Greg Berlanti. But it was my conversations with him and Sarah Gamble, who co-create the show together. And it's really Sarah Gamble's journey as a showrunner. It's her creation, her baby. it's my conversations with them that convinced me that it was like, oh, this is really doing something different and it'll be really, really interesting to do.
I have to ask you a question. Now, there's an obvious answer here, but I'm trying to go a little bit deeper. So indulge me for just a second.
Please, yeah.
Why Joe is a fairly charismatic and on the surface likable character. Right?
Yeah. He's a likable. Oh, yeah. Fully.
He's a likable guy.
Yeah.
He's a, you know, moderately attractive, of course, played by you. Moderately. Yeah. I'm stressing that word. Attractive, played by you. Why does he feel as though he must do what he does? Or is it just, I'm trying to get at what
I know what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah. Truly exploring. Like, why does he feel he must do what he does as opposed to break? Because there are several times I feel like the character is going to break away from this and he can't. Do you know why?
Well, so there's like three levels to this answer, and I don't know which one to. So on one hand, I think the writers would give you a better answer that pertains to Joe Goldberg than I can.
Okay.
As an actor, I can't really question a lot of this stuff. I just have to believe what I'm saying, and that's what I try to do. And then I think, so there's two levels to it. One is that I think the show is always meant to be more of a metaphor, or it's a work of like fiction that is somewhat fantastical and campy in the way that it's exploring the story of this man, and always at the end grounding it in something that resonates so profoundly as like emotionally consistent and true.
Yes.
So that it always comes home in this way that, like, truly good fiction is, of course, it's real because it resonates. No matter how fantastical it is, it's doing something where it is like, oh, that's, yeah, like I'm having some kind of reflection that is worthwhile because it's like there's something true here, even though it's a total fiction.
Yes.
So in that way, there's something deep happening. But I think when it comes to Joe as a killer and as a person who really does that behavior, I don't think anybody's ever tried to ground him in like the clinical reality of someone who does that, the sort of pathological makeup. You know what I mean? Because I think, like, at the end of the day, he feels too much and is maybe too inconsistent to truly be what a real killer would be like. Say, I don't know. But then us, at the same time, I think Ted Bundy was evidently very, like, I don't know. He had a lot. Didn't he have like a family? And then there's a Gacy, I guess, was like evidently loved by his community. And so, you know, I actually don't know that much about serial killers in truth. I mean, I just think that what the writers are exploring is something different. I think it's like an exercise, you know, it's like a meditation. And so there are things that Joe does that are, you know, maybe impossible or inconsistent. And that's not the point. I think the point is we're examining something and it always comes home in something that really makes sense. And so then on the other level, where if we're trying to understand why Joe really does this, which is to say why anybody could or would do this, it all has to do with, I think, unprocessed trauma. You know, when it comes to maleness, like masculinity, when it comes to whiteness, when it comes to any behavior that someone exhibits that is ultimately violent to like another group of people, because it's not, Joe does kill people, but he's uniquely violent towards women. The same way that like there's racial violence. It is, if something is racially motivated, if something is motivated by a bias, you know, by prejudice, it's my understanding, you know, many brilliant, famous thinkers have said something like this. The person who comes to mind is Bell Hooks, a black woman sort of thinker, philosopher, activist, many things. She said something to the effect of like, you know, the first casualty in, she didn't say toxic masculinity because I don't think that was so much the phrase then, but in my understanding, she's talking about like, you know, maleness, like in male violence, you know, but the first casualty is to that man, to his soul.
Hmm.
And I think it's the same in racially motivated violence, all forms of violence. You know, the first act of violence is to the person who's perpetrating it. And I think that one of the reasons this show also really resonates is that that is, we're looking at, again, not a clinical portrayal, but like this sort of, the way that something in Lord of the Rings resonates as true. It's ultimately about like what? Perseverance, about friendship, about, I don't know, like, I'm not really sure. I'm not really a Lord of the Rings person, but it's right. Like, it's not about the ring. It's about right. Something else.
Yes.
That's what this show is.
Well, that's what I think. Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, there's something about, as you mentioned before, well, one, the objectification of women by him, for sure. But I think that also, and I think what it is, why it just, the show, I can't stop watching it, is it has to do, it's something about, it's the idealization of what
love.
Yeah. And specifically totally. what Hollywood, quote unquote, or movies or shows or whatever tells us about love and
yes,
what it should be or what it can be.
Yeah.
And how it should manifest itself.
I agree with you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know that's what I've tapped into as a thinking person with my role. I don't always necessarily think about this like between action and cut. Like when I'm having a play, Joe, it's like, it just is what it is.
Yes.
But the way that it really all resonates to me is exactly what you said. Like, it isn't even about, you know, when I talk about, it isn't even really about, it isn't just about the objectification of women. It is, I think, much more about like, well, this guy, like if he's doing all this, the first person he's doing it to is himself, but because he can't recognize that, he then has to do it to other people, you know? Right. And I think that really crazy myth of love that Hollywood has unconsciously and also in some cases consciously sold us basically since its inception is that you have to feel as though you're like addicted to a friggin' drug. Otherwise there's no love. Otherwise there's no passion. And it's akin to believing in magic. It's like, if I'm not feeling these feelings, like, I can't have anything to do with love then. If it's not a practice, it's not a discipline. It's this magical feeling that visits me that I have to feel. And if I don't feel it, then I must not be in love.
Yes.
And, you know, all people, I think, are somewhat victim to this idea of love that is actually really, really unhelpful if you want to have a relationship.
Yes.
And I think Joe is more than anything victim to that. It's like, you don't understand the first thing about love.
Right.
You actually don't.
Yeah.
You actually do not understand a single thing about it. And you know what? That is sad. And you know what? The first person to get hurt and all of that is you. Hence the title. It all just...
You. Fascinating. Season 4 coming up. Your directorial debut.
That's right. Yeah.
How was that? Was that fun?
It was fun. It was also like, we didn't have time for me to watch playback. So it was chaotic. I mean, I was kind of directing with my eyes closed. So I feel good about it. I feel good about the cut. I haven't seen the final. They always take it and do their work to it. But great experience overall. Like, yeah.
Something you want to keep doing?
I don't know that I can do it on my show. In fact, I'm almost positive I can't. It was too much at the same time.
Right.
Just wasn't really because Joe is placed so centrally in the show, like there was no opportunity for me to prep adequately. Yeah. So again, the thing that enables me to do it is also the thing that hinders me from doing it. So I think like I would love, I mean, I am in the works to direct something else, but I don't think I can do it my own show. Yeah, we'll see.
You mentioned it before, Pod Crushed premiered this year, early this year.
Yeah.
How has that been?
Man, it's been a real joy, you know, because it's like, even though it's only one half of the medium of film, it's just the audio mostly, save for bonus content, which you can find on our YouTube channel. It's like, it's an exercise in production, you know? I mean, I kind of love it. Like me and my two producing partners, we're cutting our teeth with it, and it's great. It's, you know, and just the stories that we get from everybody, I think is really lovely because everybody can relate to feelings of rejection and awkwardness and insecurity. Deep insecurity. Like, it doesn't matter who you are. The level of insecurity you feel when you're in middle school,
yes,
is essentially as deep as it's ever going to get. And that, I don't know, it shapes who we are. It shapes how we see the world and what we think of it and how we see ourselves and how we behave in all of our relationships. So I think if you tap into it the right way, you can get anywhere from something that is really, really, really funny and light to something that is frankly really, really intense. And we've kind of had all those stories. We've had stories of a breakup that is so painfully awkward, but superficial because they're like 11, to stories of someone losing their mother, you know? And I mean, it literally is that spectrum. It's like, right. it's all in these, you know, stories that are written in from people who listen to the show. And then, of course, those stories are not the heart of the show. All of our guests come on and tell, you know, various stories from middle school, and we just kind of go from there. But at the end of every episode, there's a narrated story by me from one of our listeners. And, you know, it's like, as I said before, it's almost been like a way to process. I mean, I didn't finish middle school, you know,
right.
And the two people that I'm doing the show with, they're two teachers. So they not only finished middle school, they then went back to it as adults.
Right.
So, you know,
and relived it more.
Right. And so we're coming at it from a lot of angles in a way.
Well, I have been really enjoying. I've been catching up on episodes recently because, spoiler alert, there's going to be a very special guest.
How special?
On podcast. Really, really special. I can only promise specialness. I'm very much looking forward to that. Penn, thank you so much. Thanks for chatting.
Yeah, man. Thank you so much for having me on.
Congratulations on all the success, of course, and on the new season of You. And just know this, I will be watching.
Great.
You.
Great. We got a new Joe Goldberg right here.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks, Ben. Penn, awesome time talking with you. You may be the second Penn on this show, but you are absolutely tied for first place in my heart. Tied. I hope you're ready for a very special guest on your podcast. No, 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 my friend, you cannot keep me away. I am going to get pod crushed. For all you listeners, I hope you enjoyed today's episode as much as I did. Getting to know Penn. We've got a very special episode for you next week. End of the year coming round. We will see you then. Off the Beat is hosted and executive produced by me, Brian Baumgartner, alongside our executive producer, Ling Lee. Our senior producer is Diego Tapia. Our producers are Liz Hayes, Hannah Harris, and Emily Carr. Our talent producer is Ryan Papa Zachary, and our intern is Sammy Katz. Our theme song, Bubble and Squeak, performed by the one and only Creed Bratton.
The journey to a smoke-free future can be a long and winding road, but if you're ready for a change, consider taking Zyn for a spin. Zyn nicotine pouches offer a fresh way to discover your nicotine satisfaction. Anywhere, anytime. No smoke, no spit, and no lingering odor. Get in gear with the Zyn 10 Challenge and enjoy 10 smoke-free, spit-free days for just $5.95. Order online and start your new journey today. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in LA, and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Elevation with Stephen Furtick podcast was created with you in mind. This is a podcast for those feeling discouraged or needing guidance from God. Together in this podcast, we'll dive deep into scripture, uncover the powerful truths that will help you rise above your limitations and embrace your full potential. We're here to equip you with the tools you need to conquer life's challenges. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.